regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Yes, we're going to be talking about the Biden administration's newest rule published in the Federal Register. It is set to go into effect in 30 days, redefining who is engaged in the business of selling firearms. And the Biden administration has made no bones about what they're trying to do here, right? To move as close to universal background checks as possible without a vote by Congress. We've heard the vice president talk about this is closing the gun show loophole, quote unquote, which doesn't exist, by the way. Again, if you are a private seller selling a gun or two from your private collection, you are not engaged in the business. At least you haven't been engaged in the business of selling firearms. But now, again, the ATF wants to broaden that definition to encompass individuals who don't even complete a single sale of a firearm. You could still be engaged in the business. Join us to talk about this, Stephen Gutowski, the founder of The Reload, one of the sharpest Second Amendment journalists out there. I know Stephen's got a lot to talk about and say about this new proposed rule, so let's get right to it. Take a look and a listen. Stephen, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Yeah, and you know, when I asked you to come on, I had no idea what we'd be talking about, but thankfully, the Biden administration has given us something big to discuss today, the publication of the final rule on who is engaged in the business of selling firearms. And as you and I were discussing off air, there is so much spin going on here, Stephen. It is ridiculous. From the Biden administration, from the media who's covering this final rule, we're hearing all this talk about, oh, this is the closing the gun show loophole, which is not a thing to begin with, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, just straight up lied in his statement on what this rule does by claiming it closes the gun show loophole because under the regulation, it won't matter if a sale happens online or at a gun show or at a brick and mortar store when they're determining whether somebody needs a license. But as you know, and I'm probably a lot of people in the audience are well aware, that was always the case. It did never mattered where the sale happened. That was never part of the calculation for whether somebody was engaged in the business and needed to get a license.
Right.
Now, this rule does other things, not saying, you know, there isn't a lot to talk about what it does, but that's not a new thing. And he's just lied about it. And the media, honestly, I've seen a Politico story where they just straight up repeated that. I think that's why he does it, because a lot of reporters don't understand how the system works and they just go by whatever the fact sheet gets put out by the White House is, and I guess don't look much further into it.
Well, I think that's you're right. And I think that's a huge problem because, as you say, the definition of who's engaged in the business is what's changed here, right? It's not that well, these people could sell guns at gun shows and now they can't. No. As you say, if you are, again, engaged in the business as is defined in law, you need a federal firearms license. It doesn't matter if you're operating out of your home, if you've got a brick and mortar store, if you're only selling firearms online. And that's what's changed, right, is who is going to be viewed as engaged in the business. And the ATF is broadening this out to the point that you don't even have to complete a single sale. Stephen, yeah. According to the NSSF, right, just simply offering a firearm for sale from your personal collection could be enough for the ATF to say, oh, you're actually running a gun business, buddy.
Yes. And I actually wonder where we'll come down on different sides of this. But to me, when I read this regulation, certainly there's a lot of ominous warnings about what it means to be in the business. And that it could even be, you don't even have to technically make a sale. You just have to sort of indicate that you are willing to do repeated sales for profit. It doesn't have to be multiple sales. It could be a single sale. But, you know, at the same time, that is the kind of thing they've been saying for a long time at the ATF. If you remember, under the Obama administration, there was a similar effort to try and basically scare people into going out to get licenses. If they wanted to sell private guns, that's where that was the first time they said it could be as little as one gun sold. Now, I will say that certainly there are legitimately expansions in here of what they're claiming means to be engaged in the business. And they do come not just from like the ATF out of the ether. it is at least related to the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, where they changed the statutory standard from one that included livelihood, that you had to, there had to be an aspect of you making a livelihood from gun sales, to one where it's predominantly for profit. And so there, how much of a change that means in the courts will be interesting to see. Obviously, the ATF is using that to say, well, we want to expand this. So if you're selling, if you're repeatedly selling the same kind of gun over and over again at a profit, then you could need a license. There's a number of things in here, but I will say, to me, it seems like more of an attempt to cast a cloud over people selling used guns, like to try and make them think they need a license, even if it's not entirely clear they do. Unfortunately, not an uncommon thing for the ATF to do at this moment.
Yeah, and so do you think this is an effort to get more people to apply for their FFL, or is this an attempt to get more people to say, well, I mean, I'm just selling a couple of guns here. I don't need to get an FFL license. I'll just put the buyer through a background check and I'll go to an FFL to do that, because that would that suffice, first of all, to comply with this definition of who's engaged in the business?
That's an interesting question. The latter part, I do think, yeah, their goal, right? The goal here is to have more used sales go through background checks. That's what they want. They want all of them to. That's what they would like to happen, but they can't do that under current law. And so they're trying to get as close as they possibly can by either forcing people to get licenses or sort of making people who are selling their used guns think that they might need a license. And so they want to, yeah, maybe do an alternative like you're suggesting. They go transfer through an FFL, even if it's not required by their state's law, you know, which I guess would potentially be a way. I mean, I don't know, right? That's one of the things about the ATF's definitions here and the way that they like to keep things vague so that they can give themselves a lot of flexibility. We've talked about this a bunch in the past with a lot of these rules. Mm-hmm. Where they like to keep things not super clear so that there can be a little bit of room, wiggle room for them to exploit, which, you know, is a common thing for a lot of agencies to do. But, you know, it's not great for the citizen because, you know, the wiggle room could see you end up in jail, which is, you know, it's a very disturbing thing. And that's where, of course, the court system comes in to play. And a lot of this stuff, I will say, at least according to Republican staffers who supported this law, the change in language in the law, mm-hmm. You know, they claim that it was in response to what the courts were already doing on this front. Like, you had convictions for people who only made a couple $100 in profit off of a single sale. These are things that have already been happening. And so that's where it's a little less clear how much is going to change in practice. I think they want to scare people into either getting a license or like doing what you said, not selling their gun at all, or trying to go through a dealer instead of selling it themselves. You know, those sorts of options.
Yeah.
Assignment, right.
Well, I mean, you know, so it's interesting because you say it's unclear what kind of impact this is going to have real world. National Shooting Sports Foundation, in its public comment to the ATF on this proposed rule, said, quote, adoption of the rule would frighten untold numbers of collectors and other persons not actually engaged in the business to obtain licenses, create untold numbers of licensees who could then obtain firearms at wholesale, divert ATF resources away from licensee inspections and industry service and compliance, distract ATF from bona fide criminal investigations, and harm both the legitimate firearm industry and ATF operations. They went on to say, according to the Office of Management and Budget, the proposed rule is considered a significant regulatory action, and as such, is required to go through a regulatory impact process. The private and administrative costs estimated by the ATF, according to NSSF, are significantly understated. NSSF says the rule would cost private citizens about $338 to obtain a new license, $35 to $194 annually to maintain that license. Additionally, this new rule would cost the government $116 million just to process the new licenses. And they cite the memorandum proposed ATF licensing rule from John Dunham and Associates from October of last year. So that's just the cost, according to the NSSF, of processing the licenses, right? And then, you know, as they point out, let's say this works as the Biden administration intends, right? So now you've got this influx of new FFLs. Well, the gun control lobby already complains there aren't enough ATF agents to go out and inspect all of the FFLs that are around already. So what happens now when you expand dramatically this pool of federal firearms licensees and the ATF is now tasked with inspecting them in addition to all of the other brick and mortar gun stores? It seems to be like this is, first of all, it's a solution in search of a problem, but it is going to create a lot of problems, not only for gun owners, but for the agency itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a fair assessment. Although one thing I would say about that is it's actually fairly difficult to get an FFL if you're just like a regular person who's going to sell their like one or two guns.
But right? How can it be how can it be that difficult if you're just selling one or two guns if the government says you need the license?
Yeah, that's the catch, right? Is that this has been an ongoing fight for a long time too. If you remember the Clinton administration, they wanted to reduce how many gun dealers there were because right. of the kitchen table dealer stuff, and so they made it harder to obtain those licenses because you got to have you got to be zoned for, you can't do it out of like your apartment if it's not zoned, or your house if it's not zoned for it. It's kind of like definitely part of this whole situation, from my view at least, is they're implying that people need to get these licenses or you know, just casting this cloud over giving people doubts about whether they can sell their used guns legally without a license. And then, but then it's hard to get the license. So, it's kind of you either don't sell your gun or you do consignment through somebody who's already a licensed dealer, like you suggested earlier. And, but you know, that's their goal, is they don't want these private sales to happen. Like, I just right. think that's the stated fact from the administration. They say that, like, it's not a conspiracy thing. They want universal background checks, but they can't get the law passed. So instead they're doing it sort of a piecemeal approach. It's not required by law necessarily, but we're going to make it a little bit, cast this dark cloud over what is legal to do without a license. So maybe you should go get one of those licenses. But hey, it's actually very hard to get one of those licenses for your average person, mm-hmm. especially the hassle involved for if you're only going to sell a couple guns a year, if that. And so, you know, the implication is that you should maybe not sell those guns, or you should go and do it through a dealer that already has a license. That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah. So I'm like 99.9% sure that this law is going to face a court challenge. Do you agree?
Probably. Yeah, I would think so, right? I will say too that it might have a little bit more of a chance of surviving challenges than some of the earlier ATF rules. Just
okay.
Because,
why do you say that?
Well, because it is based on a change to statutory language, right? Now, it's a change to statutory language that goes from saying livelihood to and profit to just predominantly profit. So, what exactly that means is not totally clear, and it probably won't be clear until courts start handling cases based off. That's where this is really going to be fleshed out, is when the ATF actually starts trying to prosecute people under this new rule. And we'll see what the courts have to say. I mean, there's a long history. This is one of the problems with changing statutory language, even if it seems like almost a synonym, a synonymous sort of definition might seem mm-hmm. slightly less strict. Like livelihood is a different standard than just predominantly profit, right? But there's a whole case law. There's a whole bunch of cases that go to that first definition that now has changed. And so you're going to have to wait to see a whole bunch of new cases that come out and how courts are going to interpret that statutory change. And that's where you have more leeway, I think, as the ATF to do this sort of thing, because Congress changed the statute. They said, oh, it's not this old standard, it's this new standard. Well, what does that new standard mean? That's what this rule is trying to interpret. Now, you have had some pushback from Republican lawmakers, at least, who voted for that change. You had Senator Cornyn from Texas and Senator Ernst. They both told me back when this proposal came out that they believe it isn't in line with the statutory change. So that could come into play in these court cases. You know, they were arguing that the statutory change is just reflective of how the courts had handled cases on licensed dealers before. But yeah, like I said, I think it gives the ATF a bit more of a foundation to try and do this from, as opposed to the pistol brace ban or, you know, the 80% lowers, those sort of rules that they've instituted, especially because those were often in opposition to things they'd said previously. And this rule doesn't really go back on anything the ATF was saying before. Like, there's not a lot of flip-flopping here. And even if there were, it's accompanied by that actual statute change.
Yeah, I think one of the issues is going to be whether or not the statute change in the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act conflicts with the Gun Control Act of 1968, and whether or not you know, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act specifically overrides the section of the Gun Control Act that talks about and defines who's engaged in the business and what that means. You know, there's another interesting aspect of this, and it's a minor one, but I think it does speak again to the just the anti Second Amendment hostility of the administration and the ATF under Steve Dettelbach. As the NSSF noted, the ATF defines at length a personal collection or a personal collection of firearms that they define as a person accumulating for study, comparison, exhibition, or for a hobby, e.g. non-commercial recreational activities for personal enjoyment, such as hunting or skeet targeted competitive shooting. Self-defense apparently is not seen as a valid reason by the ATF to own one or more firearms, Stephen, which I find, again, I don't think any legal case is going to hinge on the lack of self-defense inclusion there. But it's worth noting that, you know, even now, the Biden administration refuses to recognize why most Americans own firearms, right? And that is to protect themselves and their loved ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a symbolic thing in there. Like, I definitely, you know, it does make you say, oh, that's interesting that they're not even considering self-defense as one of the reasons you might have a personal collection of firearms. But, you know, and I do think it comes down the sort of, you know, I'm talking about this dark cloud, right? And that's kind of a vague thing to talk about. But to me, it, you know, the a lot of what's in there is about, you know, some of it's, you know, repetitive dealing. The repetitive is a common thing that you'll see. And it's like, well, what does that mean? What does repetitive mean? And they don't really give you a specific answer. Because again, they say it could be a single gun. You don't even have to actually sell the guns. You just have to sort of express the intent that you're going to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, and for profit, like, okay, they'd say, oh, you know, refreshing your collection is legitimate and not considered something where you need a license. What if you, I mean, if you have a gun collection and you've had a collection for a long time and there happen to be valuable pieces in it, you're going to turn a profit if you sell some of those guns, most likely.
Right.
So what is that? How does that look? And that's where, like, this is where the cloud comes in. Like, is making any money off a gun, could that be considered something that the ATF might go after you for? In practice, probably not. But that's where the dark cloud comes in. It's like, because it's explicitly clear that that's not the case, and that's the hard part about it. It's like, you know, at a certain, sometimes you might want them to have a specific number that they put it at. Okay, if you sell this many guns, because if you don't have that, then you get this instead. And it's like, we don't really know what makes you a dealer or not. Here are some things that might make you a dealer, or a combination of these things. But we can't really say for sure exactly. The ATF does this with all kinds of stuff, right?
The pistol brace. I was going to say they did it with the pistol braces, right? We can't tell you for sure. Probably it's a brace, but yeah, you know, right. And again, the idea is, you know, that we should err on the side of caution by doing what the ATF suggests, right? Because otherwise, we could be charged with a federal felony and sentenced to 10 years behind bars.
Yeah. And that's the real problem, right? Is like, nothing, there's not a lot in here that's different from things they've said before. But, you know, if you make the calculation wrong, it's just like when they put out their point system for the pistol brace initially, they got rid of it later, but it was like, all right, well, this is confusing. I don't know exactly if I'm counting right or if I'm counting the way the ATF would count. So it's the same thing here. Like, okay, well, if I'm selling a gun for my personal collection that I bought 30 years ago, that's worth, you know, 10 times what it was when I bought it, and I'm doing that with the intention of upgrading my collection, do I fall into that? They have that, you know, like you mentioned, the sort of explicit definition of where you're not harmed, but there's going to be it's going to be hard to figure out. Like, is that going to be considered a deal that I should have had a license for? Am I in the business because I made a profit off this gun that I sold, or if I sell my whole collection because I need to finance my roof repair or something, like, and I make a bunch of money off of that?
Yeah.
Do I need a license to do that? Like, that's repeated sales of the same make and model. Like, I can understand what they mean. It's like, okay, you show up at a gun show every week and you're just reselling, Glocks that you bought, 100 miles away because you got them cheaper up there and you're reselling them. And okay, so these, you could see why that might be somebody considered to be in business. They're renting a table. They've got a business card that says reseller John, whatever. But what if I just have a bunch of Glock 19s that I got, and I decide I want to get rid of a couple of them? They're the same make and model, selling more than one of them at a time. Like, is that, where's that line drawn? And that's what's not explicit, and that's where the dark cloud comes in. And I think that's intentional.
I do too. And you're right. There is no clear, bright line. I would say, at best, there is a vague and fuzzy line in the sand, and you don't really know when you've crossed it, right? Because we're being kept in the dark. Well, listen, Stephen, I appreciate your perspective. We will see where this goes. As you said, I think we're sure to see at least one court challenge, probably more. We'll see if those challenges are filed before the rule takes effect, or if we wait until the rule takes effect so we can have standing to sue. But this is not the end of the story here.
Yeah. And look, to be fair too, that's kind of where things are already at in terms of vagueness. The current standards, what they've said over the years, it's already to this degree, it's somewhat to this degree of like, you don't really know. And what really matters are the actual cases they bring against people over this stuff and what the judges decide. The big problem, as I alluded to earlier, is that all gets reset now because of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. So it's really hard to tell.
Yeah, one of the big issues is going to be with the language of GCA talking about the repetitive nature of the sales, and then the ATF rule now saying, well, I mean, you don't even have to complete a sale, right? I think that to me is a pretty stark difference between the statutory language of GCA and what the rule of the ATF is trying to put into effect now. There's a conflict there.
And we'll have to see what happens if they ever try to bring a case like that.
Right.
But that's the problem with having the standard. Even if they don't try to bring a case, it's still hanging out there. Like, maybe we'll bring a case.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. All right, Stephen, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir. Remind folks how they can subscribe to The Reload.
Yeah, you head over to thereload.com and sign up for our free newsletter. Just get a taste of what we're doing over there. And then, of course, if you want to support us, you can buy a membership and you get exclusive access to hundreds of pieces of analysis and early access to our podcast and all kinds of other stuff.
Well, listen, I'm always glad we get a chance to spend some time together. Thanks so much for having me on The Reload podcast recently. And I'm looking forward to doing this again soon.
Absolutely.
My thanks to Stephen for joining us on the program. We are obviously going to be following this very, very closely. I do anticipate, yes, we are going to see lawsuits filed over this new proposed rule. It's a matter of when, I think, and not if. So stay tuned, because there is much more to come about the ATF's new rule here. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for just a second. At the heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred: free speech. It is the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future are being silenced or overshadowed in mainstream narratives, leaving many feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. This is where Wealth Protection Research steps in. Armed with a mission that's never been more critical, Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They're defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. Wealth Protection Research tirelessly seeks out financial experts. These are the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report. This free report highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas the mainstream media won't touch. Listeners can get a copy completely free. Just text IDEAS to 76626. To claim that free copy. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told. to hear the ideas the establishment doesn't think you can handle and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. All right. Today's recidivist report. Let's start there. My colleague John Sexton covered this at Hot Air, but I have to talk about it because this is truly the insanity of the left on full display. A Berkeley educated engineer getting probation after being caught on camera trying to poison a coworker and successfully poisoning a coworker, I might add. I mean, the coworker did not die, thankfully, but the individual who's the subject of this poison still dealing with all kinds of health issues. David Zhu, charged with attempted murder back in 2019 for lacing his colleague's water bottle with cadmium over what the New York Post describes as imagined professional jealousies. The victim thought she was suffering from late-term cancer. She suffered a heart attack at one point, but she again survived this poisoning. She began experiencing symptoms in 2017. And, you know, Zhu would express sympathy for, oh, I'm so sorry, what's going on? Maybe you need to undergo some, you know, medical tests. She eventually discovered what was going on when she gave her parents her water bottle so they could use it to cook some rice. And then they got sick. And so then she started to go, oh, man. So she set up a hidden camera in her office. And that's when she saw Zhu fiddling with the water bottle at her desk. She handed the bottle over to authorities. They discovered the high levels of cadmium. Zhu initially charged with attempted murder, held on $2 million bond. But he bonded out of jail after a little more than a week. He was released on house arrest, fitted with an ankle monitor at one point to track his movement. Eventually, prosecutors dropped the most severe charge, and he was convicted of poisoning as part of a plea deal in September of 2023. Alameda County DA Pamela Price agreed to a sentence that will allow Zhu to avoid prison by instead serving probation. Now, the victim in this case says she's concerned that Zhu will repeat his crime in the future. She pointed out that she continues to suffer from the poisoning. She's lost nearly $500,000 in income because of the injuries that she has received. She wrote, I have concerns that the criminal may use his expertise in chemical engineering and fire investigation to commit future crimes, such as poisoning or arson. Which sounds like a legitimate concern, but honestly, even if there's, let's say there's no chance that Mr. Zhu is going to reoffend here. Now, we don't know that that's, you don't know, right? You assume. But still, he spent a week behind bars for this. That's the only time that he'll spend behind bars for trying to kill his colleague. And the district attorney in Alameda County signed off on this deal. She's okay with allowing somebody who tried to murder a colleague to walk free after, what, a week in jail and some time on an ankle monitor? Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't even know if the probation is going to require him to keep that ankle monitor on. Probably not. And if he violates that probation, odds are, given that this is California we're talking about, nothing's going to happen. Now, today's Armed Citizen story from Alabama, where the owner of the Pita Shop restaurant will not face charges after he shot a customer during a dispute. This is in Birmingham, Alabama. Matt Islam is the owner of the Pita Shop. And the shooting took place back in December of last year. There was an argument at the store between a customer and Islam. The customer, identified as 30-year-old Ricardo Tafoya Garcia, was in a verbal dispute with Islam. Apparently, there was a argument over payment. Garcia claimed that he had already paid the Jefferson County DA, Danny Carr. So the evidence shows that wasn't true, that Garcia had not actually paid for his food. And when Islam tried to get him to pay, that is when Garcia assaulted the restaurant owner. Only then, according to prosecutors, did Matt Islam grab a gun and defend himself, shooting and ultimately killing Garcia. The DA says they turned the case over to a grand jury who chose not to indict him. He said, in this case and in this state, if a person's about to be assaulted or has been assaulted or is being assaulted, and it's reasonable under the circumstances, in some instances, deadly force is going to be justified. And in this case, it was. Islam's attorney released a statement as well, saying that a momentous weight has been lifted from Matt Islam's shoulders. The last thing he ever imagined was being forced to defend himself anywhere, especially at his restaurant. Went on to say, I think it's important to note that Matt started off as a dishwasher and worked his way up to become a joint owner of this longtime favorite restaurant in Birmingham. Matt feels deeply for the deceased, who gave him no other choice. He added, we recognize that this event not only profoundly affected our client, but is also tragic for friends and family of the deceased, and we extend our condolences to them. Also said, we're grateful that the district attorney, Danny Carr, who after thorough investigation presented this case to the grand jury, that clearly recognized a clear case of self-defense, which confirmed our independent investigation. So, again, several months after the shooting occurred, Matt Islam informed that he was justified in defending his life with a firearm. And again, no charges will be filed. Finally, today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A Amazon driver from Greensboro, North Carolina, who ended up saving a 76-year-old woman who was involved in a crash in Asheboro, North Carolina. This was just a couple of days ago. Shirley Roberts ended up flipping her car over an embankment. Amanda Smith was the Amazon driver. She was out doing deliveries in Asheboro when she spotted the crash. She said, I thought I was seeing things at first. Something just came over me and it didn't feel right. So I pulled over, and when I looked down the road, there was a car laid out. So Amanda immediately got on the phone with 911, gave her the address or gave dispatchers the address. And then she yelled out, hey, are you okay? She didn't get an answer. Others at that point had seen what was going on. They also stopped, and there was a joint rescue operation for this woman. Amanda Smith said they immediately jumped down the embankment. They went down. They checked on her. They saw that she was alive and moving and okay. Soon after, crews arrived on the scene. They used the jaws of life to pry the 76-year-old woman, Shirley Roberts, out of the car. It took nearly half an hour. Amanda Smith says she's glad that her instincts kicked in, but her daughter-in-law, Eleanor Roberts, said, quote, I'm a firm believer in God. I know that when she told me that, it was the Holy Spirit guiding her to show her that there was more than just a tire there. Well, whether this was God giving her a sign, this was just Amanda Smith's instincts kicking in, whatever, it sounds like it was fairly miraculous that she spotted the vehicle that had been overturned, was able to alert authorities and get Shirley Roberts the help that she needed so that she can survive that car crash, which could easily have been deadly for the 76-year-old. In the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Amanda Smith there in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as the other Good Samaritans who saw what was going on and came to Shirley Roberts' aid as well. A big tip of the cap to everyone involved. Now, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you again next Monday as we cover more of the latest Second Amendment news and information. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping the website up to date as well. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code SAVEAMERICA. You can get a significant savings on your VIP or VIP membership. We're going to give you exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. It's our way of saying thanks for showing your support, because it really does matter and it truly does make a difference. So thank you again. Enjoy the rest of your week. Looking forward to seeing you back here in a couple of days. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.